this, which is really problematic in that I like to use my hands. So we'll see how it goes and go from there. It's just about 4:30. I've got an hour and a half presentation to do in an hour, and so I appreciate everybody who came back who was thinking that I was going to be on earlier today, and due to some flight schedules, got here just a little while ago. So we'll get started. Normally, I'll take questions during the presentation, but because we're short on time and I've got a long presentation, let's try to hold off. But if you absolutely have to, just scream them out, and I'll try to address them during the presentation. So, let's get going here. Is this on? On? You don't happen to have a lapel mic back there, do you? Should always learn to request those up front. So, I've been using this tagline for about a year and a half now, and it's still appropriate. Security is to the internet as... Anybody want to shout out the answer? Anybody know the answer? Anybody been to one of my presentations before and seen this one? Fish is to bicycles? Did I hear that right? Anybody else? Not the one I was thinking of. Here, I'll give you a clue. It's a little morbid, but I'll give you a clue. Stole that from Reuters. Safety is to commercial aviation. All right. Not my quote, but I like it a lot. It was from Barksdale about a year and a half ago when he basically said, if we had kept aviation security at 1937 levels and increase the traffic to 1999 levels, we'd be dropping 2 747s out of the sky every day. Not a good thing to happen. So obviously we've got a long way to go here. We're going to talk about mobile code today. Hopefully everybody was expecting us to talk about mobile code today. Almost all of the sites today have some form of mobile code. Most of it is script-based. Just for those who are here for the very first time, it's usually referred to as JavaScript, Visual Basic Script, applets, Java applets, ActiveX controls, of course. Even embedded plugins, even Excel spreadsheets can be carriers of malicious code. Oftentimes we'll see them in greeting cards, we'll see them in different formats, in games, and we'll be moving them around the internet in many different forms, usually in an automated sense. So oftentimes these things are executed automatically, and I think that's where we have some concerns. I like this quote, actually. Anybody know Zivernovsky? Anybody heard of him? Yeah, a few Europeans here, maybe. The guy is definitely out on the fringe. But actually, if you read through the quote, and this was right after Love Letter, we can bring the West to its knees. Okay, exciting stuff. Here's the sensationalist guy talking about what he can do. Think about all the guys who are actually doing it and not telling us about what they're doing. So ultimately, you have to ask, are you at risk? Do you use these applications? Do you open files? Do you actually allow things to come into your network? Oftentimes, the answer is going to be, yeah, I use these things. And if you use these things, oftentimes, you're going to be at risk. All kinds of greeting cards, all kinds of jokes that come into you that are executable. I have to caution, not all greeting cards are bad. A lot of them are web-based and have no coding behind them at all. But certainly a lot of them do come to you as executables. And oftentimes, most of the industry is going to actually respond to these by opening them. And it's really easy to do. In a longer presentation, I go through several more slides, and I actually go through the 1, 2, 3s of how to point and click your way to a Trojan. Here, I've got to do it in one slide because we're a little bit short on time. But if you actually search for any of these tools out there, and some of you may have even written these tools, you can actually create your own. This one, Joiner, is actually pretty easy. It even has a GUI interface. So you put the bad file name in there. You put the good file name in there. And I'm being deliberately controversial. This may or may not be a good or a bad file. You can make your own decisions there. But you put a bad thing, you put a good thing, and you get a thing that looks good on top, and underneath it's bad, right? Trojan, we all know about the term. And you can do this in 30 minutes or less, just by doing simple web searches. So don't try this at home, right? Kids script kiddies. So I want to do an example. Some of you may say, wow, an example. Others, after you see the example, may say, well, that was pretty non-novel. But I'll do it anyway, just because it's on the schedule and on the agenda. So what I've got here is, unfortunately, I use Lotus Notes. No offense to the Lotus people, but that's what I'm stuck with. So you see a Lotus inbox there. And I'll click on the email I sent myself with a couple of attachments. And lo and behold, there's a couple of games in here. And I'll do what every user does and say, I want to see what the pinwheel does. So I'll go ahead and launch that thing. And as we sit here and watch the pinwheel spin around and say, wow, that's kind of nifty, we wonder, is there anything else happening? So I'll hit escape. And lo and behold, as you expected, because this is a demo, we actually did some stuff behind the scenes. Let me just reduce some of these screens for a second and move this off to the side. This directory here didn't actually exist before I ran this program. If I view that, actually will open the directory contents. I see that there's a couple of doc files in there, an Excel file. Basically, as I was viewing this pinwheel going around and around, this little program went out, searched my directory, looked for some doc files, certainly could have looked for anything, could have been much more intense. It could have actually looked for files that have confidential on them or in them, could have looked for certain types of data, and could have captured it, and certainly under the assumption that this was happening on an open internet port, could have siphoned these out of the machine, passed them somewhere else. Let's keep looking at the demo here for a second. If this was something like a Sony Vaio laptop with one of the cameras built in, I could have actually seen some recording off of the camera. I don't have a Sony Vaio. I have a different brand here, but I certainly can listen. Let me see if I've got that.
And as we sit here and watch the pinwheel spin around and say, wow, that's kind of nifty.
Right, so what you know, a little simple turn on the microphone technique here. So everybody always says, well, you know, I'll just turn off the microphone. I'll disable that function. And I say, well, you know, I introduced a piece of code onto your system. And so using that piece of code, I could have reinstalled all the drivers you turned off or just deleted from your system. So short of cutting the wire between the microphone and your machine, very little you can actually do to prevent that kind of listening thing. Of course, with the camera, you could put a piece of tape on there, but that's no fun. In this case, I recorded very short amount of data. If you look at the WAV file that I actually captured, it's 54K for 4 seconds. Obviously, a very large file. What I could do is I could certainly install internet telephony software onto your machine and just open up a listening port. Much better than planting bugs at the State Department. I think that if you actually think about industrial espionage issues, there's a lot more interesting activities and discussions happening in places like Symantec or Microsoft or some other corporation where there's some really nifty development happening than the State Department talking about issues of state. So if I was trying to do something in the malicious sense, turning on a listening device in various offices in a corporation might be one of the things I might do. And of course, I could have siphoned out any other type of content that might be interesting to me at any point in time. So these are all things that were done while I was watching the pinwheel. Of course, I didn't have to reveal the fact that I did all this. This was a demo, so I did that. But obviously, lots of Trojanized kind of things can be floating around. Let's go to the program already in progress and continue on. So, personal surveillance protection. Have we done anything here that is very dangerous? Probably. Is it possible to protect yourself? You have to ask these questions. Can you prevent PCs from being bugged? Can you prevent things from getting onto the PC that would make you vulnerable? Friends of all of ours over at the Department of Defense basically said, they've been doing this stuff for years, and it's so easy to put it on people's machines and turn them into listening devices. So this whole personal surveillance protection is pretty interesting. Where's the antivirus, right? So, this is the classic. You come up here, you stand here. I got my other guys from Symantec here as well. And of course, everybody says, well, antivirus, is it going to work? Well, sure, it works. But traditional pattern matching isn't going to necessarily deal with all the novel attacks that may be coming. We need something a little bit more intelligent. We need something that isn't necessarily going to be code scanning and looking for patterns that we might have to match against a known database of some hostile or malicious activities. Most of the code that the user is experiencing will not have been anticipated or seen by the folks developing security software in advance of its arrival on the machine, on the endpoint, or on the machine where the compromise is being attempted. And so therefore, with limited dynamic inspection, you have certain capabilities that are certainly valid, and pattern matching code scanning is still valid, and a majority of the attacks are circumvented using those types of techniques. But we have to look at where we go next. Now, traditionally, we know about heuristics, statistical assessment of the situation, but we fear and we have concern over false positives, the overblocking conditions that may result. So we have to have some other approaches as well. If you look at what some of the industry analysts are saying, and some of you may not care because you may not necessarily buy into what the analysts are saying, but reactive detection is not versatile enough, right? And even if you look at the details of that, issuing the reactive solution afterwards sometimes allows penetrations to occur and some damage to occur as fast as they may be. So even if you get down to the bottom here where you look at digital immune systems, where it's a closed loop feedback system that allows new information to be shipped over to the antivirus vendor so that definitions can be generated very quickly, this is still traditionally reactive environments. So we have to allow for some next generation ideas to reach out and solve these problems. Even the AV vendors, and I've been using this slide for a while too, but I love this slide because it actually picks on the AV vendors, and I get to pick on myself. Dan Schrader over at Trend, inherently reactive systems. Over at Network Associates, the McAfee folks, impossible to detect all the variants. Right? And even a guy I know and love now, Gary Notchenberg over at Symantec down in Santa Monica, saying, hey, wait a minute, we've got a tough problem here. We need to think about how we're going to deal with these types of threats. Our friends over at the ICSA do their annual study. They had some good things to say about where this problem is going. We are looking at very significant risk moving forward as we see more sophisticated Trojanized type attacks and as we see the normal community falling prey to very simple electronic social engineering techniques. So where does that really bring us? What we have to look at now are things like behavior blocking, right? Monitoring the code as it executes, monitoring the behavior of the code as it executes, looking for code that deviates from policy that may have been established to control the unknown code, letting other systems terminate malicious code before the malicious code actually does something bad, looking at ways where we don't have to rely on traditional databases, right, on traditional pattern databases, looking at ways where you don't have to update technology, update your pattern database so that you can actually continue to work and feel confident that your systems are in place. This idea of behavior blocking truly complements what traditionally has been reactive systems. So, if you look at some of the stuff that happened historically, about a year ago I was sitting at DEF CON down the street, and I believe this was during the CDC presentation, and Sir Disick actually went into this discussion of how do you stop these types of attacks. Interestingly enough, there had been some research done about on this topic which really paralleled what Sir Disick was talking about, and it really had to do with throwing something down at ring zero that could trap the calls, can monitor between various application services that are requested and operating system services downstream. You create a wrapper of sorts that forces the application to then run through this driver in ring zero, and that way you can add your policy around what it is that you're trying to stop. This kind of technology actually works very well, but still has a flaw in that you end up having a significant behavior blocking side effect, which is false positives. So you have to have some type of way to manage the results of those false positives. If you look at some of the new research that's happening now, you actually look at specific problems, and you look at the problems of scripts in particular. Right? And so if we look at some of the research coming out of our research center, we're looking at ways to block some of the scripts that have occurred in the last year and a half. The love letter type scripts, the Melissa type scripts, and so forth. What you're trying to do is make sure that the services that these external programs are calling, right? It's a collusion, right, between something that comes in and something that already exists. And you have to establish that the links between those two services could be harmful. And so if you're actually looking at the way that the comm services work and the services that the scripts are calling, look at how you respond to those. What you don't want to do is necessarily block access to those services by legitimate applications, or at least commercial applications like Outlook. What you do want to do is block access to those services by programs that you don't anticipate needing those services. So you can actually do that and reduce this concept of false positives or this overblocking situation. This then solves some of the damaging behavior, some of the dangers from the script-based attacks that take advantage of various comm objects that are already on your system. There's the concept that has been introduced then is called Gatekeeper, and I'll refer to it through the rest of the presentation. The Gatekeeper technology then very effectively sits there and looks for the scripts that are coming in, right? We talked about those. It provides the protection against the types of attacks that we've seen. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to block against all types of attacks, but it certainly does mean that you're going to block against things that you've seen before, as well as things that you might not have seen, but may fall into the same types of categories of taking advantage of access to comm objects. You're looking at various email services, right, because these are how the programs are getting introduced. If you look at the technology that I had talked about before, the research that came out over a year ago, what you're actually doing is you're observing the various applications that are used to bring in code onto the machine, things like Outlook or Eudora or FTP or some other service of that type. And when the code comes in, you wrap it and you're able to then force it to run through the driver. Well, that has a set of inherent flaws or theories that don't necessarily work. For example, can you end run the wrapping process, or can you strip out the wrapper once some object, executable object, has been introduced? Here, you're still looking at the various client applications, and you're saying, okay, I don't want to overblock those client applications, right, like Outlook, but I do want to stop the spread. I do want to stop the propagation. At the very least, what we want to do is slow down the threat, slow down the risks. Oops. Right, so Win32 is where we're playing here. The idea is don't introduce a lot of overhead in any type of security service. We will have a version that you can play with soon. We are examining open source concepts as well, although I'm not positive we'll be able to support that, but we're certainly looking in that direction. The idea is you can either add it as a complement or a standalone application. So let's go into how it works, because we want to stay technical here about a research in progress here. The way that scripts works is they actually tend to leverage other services, as we said, that already exist in the operating system environment in Windows. Most of these objects are known, right? You're not actually bringing, or the payload doesn't necessarily introduce new objects of this kind. It's taking advantage of things that have been pre-installed. So if you want to actually respond to those, you want to limit the nasty capabilities or the dangerous capabilities of some of these types of objects. When you do that, you want to make sure that you're not allowing these objects to go off and cause the damage that they are being leveraged to cause today. What about the good scripts? How are you going to respond to those? Well, you can use some technologies that have been around for a while, signing, for example. And you can actually take advantage of code signing or script signing to introduce keys that would be recognized and then allow the good code or the corporate code to come in. How do you tell the good guys from the bad guys? You know, that's always a big problem, right? I don't necessarily know that we have an answer to that, because it's very hard to do. But if you do add the key concept to all of this, on top of the gatekeeper strategy, then you can actually allow people who create good scripts to sign those scripts and then allow those scripts to then be introduced and executed. We'll go into that a little bit further. What I want to do, and I guess I've been rushing in the interest of time, but it looks like we've got plenty of time, is go through some of the mechanics of how this might work. So you have this service, this W script, which is going to then allow the script that's been introduced by, say, Outlook or the web service, the web browser, to access various back-end services. So the source passes through here, gets parsed, the instructions get sent into the script engine to get executed. If you look at what happens then, you have the script engine communicating back over to create, say, files on the file system and to generate objects. Create the object then sends back, I've been created. You then want to execute the services around that object and invoke it. So at that point, the object is running, and there's no control over it. If you actually go then to the other mechanism where you have a gatekeeper with the gate key intercepts the request and can actually look for its key inside the script, instructs the code engine to then parse and execute. And if the gatekeeper is in place, then you're able to take that information, then parse it and control its execution as it goes through. Right? So at that point, you've got a middleman application that's going to prevent certain services from being executed maliciously. Keep going there. Intercepts the calls, checks to see if there's a valid key. If the keys are valid, the thing will get executed and everybody's happy. If the keys are invalid, as we'll see on the next slide, the calls won't be allowed to take place. So if there's no key here and there's a call that's being monitored by the gatekeeper, right, because you don't want a bad call to go through, then the key will prevent, or the lack of the key will prevent the execution or the invocation of the shell. This is an example of the log here. So you see a number of services that may be available to you. Once you have this information, you can actually do a lot with it, such as trace back what services are being requested and respond to those. So for example, you may actually trace the SUN processes that are created, right? So if something comes in through or into Outlook, Outlook then spawns off a process, a script process. You can see the various services that are called, and then you can respond to some of those services, such as not allowing the file open to occur. Right? The cartoon.exe could be the pinwheel that we generated. I didn't.
Are you saying that, you know, we're actually looking at the objects that are being called or the actual function calls that
are being requested? Here you see the reference to the other objects, the DLLs and services that are being invoked or requested to be invoked, but you can actually look at both. All right. This is obviously some ideas that are still in process in our labs. I actually have the architect for this with us here, so I'm going to defer some of the questions to him since he was kind enough to show up as well. But generally, we do have some additional work that needs to be done here in order to allow this to actually work. So this is still a theory, but it looks like a pretty good theory. Obviously, we want finer granularity, finer control over what does get executed, what does get blocked.
What you're showing us here is the DB script, so the script engine. Your sample earlier was pinwheel.exe.
No. Again, the industry is evolving in response to the threats that are out there. So the first demo that I showed was an executable, and the script engine won't necessarily solve that problem, at least not immediately. But to the extent that you could actually go back to something like this and start tracking the process calls and the services that are requested of an executable, you could in fact start to respond in that same way. That was actually the other technology that I was referring to from last year, the kernel level drivers that can intercept those types of calls and then respond. But what I then migrated to was the script engine only. So I would say this is a first pass toward getting to where we need to be to respond to things like the pinwheel and still have enough fine-grained control over what does get executed and what doesn't. A lot of it is going back to things like policy management. And the hard part about policy management is that you can't allow policy management to be owned by an end user because most end users won't understand what to do. And in a corporate or a larger scale managed service environment, you have to have the ability to make exceptions. And to make exceptions in a large organization becomes a very difficult problem. So a lot of this does go back to how much control, how much monitoring can we introduce. I believe that I've really come toward close to the end here, so we can, I did run through this a lot faster than I had anticipated. This was just a kind of humorous little slide here, job security forever here. I'll go ahead and field the questions that you have, and we'll see where we go, and maybe keep it more interactive. In what sense? That you're going to move the applications off base? Or? Right. Right. I'm going to answer that through referring back to the Java 2. Security models and not necessarily the Microsoft ones, simply because I actually have a better frame of reference from the Java 2 security side. If you look at what happened with Java 2, they provided the ability to assign minute functions within the Java app that was being delivered. So you could actually deliver a Java app that wouldn't need any signature-based approvals up until certain functions were required. Such as if you actually interacted with the application to the point where you needed to create an object on the file system, you would actually be required to approve that certificate that came with that small part of the code. The problem was that most application developers would never in the right mind start to introduce code signing at the functional level, and what would be much easier to do is simply say, here's this thing that I wrote for an Oracle application. I need all service access. And so effectively, while you didn't limit the controls, you would have gone back to the same model of code signing, which is I need all or nothing. So to the extent that you're saying, if I understood you correctly, does code signing solve the problem? I think code signing goes a long way to help. Right, because then I can simply reject things that are not signed and only accept things that are signed. But to the extent that what's signed is basically given carte blanche access to every service that's on your machine, I don't know that it fully solves the problem. I would say that's a valid point. I mean, I think the services are there to allow developers to get to that level of service, even if they did. how would you deploy it? What policies would you use to basically say, those objects signed by that group of people are allowed this level of access or this level of capability down in my machine? Those are very difficult problems of how you're going to actually accept the different levels of service. I see still puzzlement, so I guess I... Yeah, and again, I apologize that I'm not as up to speed on what Microsoft is proposing with their .NET, because most of it, kind of like ActiveX back in the early days, was paper stuff. So it's hard to know exactly what the details are behind it. Sure. I mean, it goes to the quality of the code problem, which we're still going to have developers writing code that may have flaws in it. And so the extent that you can monitor those flaws or the anomalies and the unexpected results, that's a very valid direction to take the security services. Sure. I think if you look back, you look at how products get adopted in the marketplace, and oftentimes very novel innovation takes a long time to incubate in people's minds. People have to understand what it does for them, how they're going to deploy it. This stuff is far from being scalable at this point, far from being deployable in a commercial sense. So to manage this across a wide-scale enterprise requires a lot of other infrastructure development. So while we may have these theories, and certainly people have been thinking about this problem for a while, it's still a hard problem to deploy, a hard solution to deploy. Absolutely. That's a key to this whole thing. Is policy management distribution? We're still struggling with having a good answer there. I don't know that anybody today can honestly come forward and say, hey, I've solved policy management distribution, because you know what? The academicians haven't even figured it out yet. Not that they're always on the cutting edge, but they're still struggling with this thing at Cornell. They're struggling with it at Cambridge and other places. And again, even Li Gong's stuff out in Sun was very brilliant, but not necessarily widely deployable. People have a difficult time taking those technologies and making them work in the enterprise. The problem with perimeter defense and code execution, you can certainly do a level of heuristics and try to anticipate what it may do. But because there's so many different platform interdependencies, something that you may think is valid in a heuristic sense out at some gateway point may not necessarily be true when it gets to the endpoint, and the environment then has other variables introduced that allow that program to become malicious or to become rogue or to just have defects. So oftentimes moving the problem away from the endpoint or the machine at the tail end of the network is not necessarily the answer. To put it at the perimeter point or network interconnect point may not always work. But that is valid, and I think we'll continue to see services being applied at middle points. Yes and no, actually. IPsec certainly throws some kinks into it, but traditional application layer crypto stuff could actually be proxied. And there are a number of technologies that allow proxying of encrypted traffic. So the problem there is performance, really. Can you afford to allow your traffic to be proxied? So. Mm-hmm. Right, and that's a valid point regarding the keys. Whenever somebody signs any type of object, the assumption is that that's a trusted source, and only the trusted people have the keys. But to the extent that the trusted person becomes untrusted and still has access to the key, then that code could, in fact, be malicious, though the system would trust it. Now, you could, in an ideal world, you can have different levels of trust and different level of monitoring for different keys. So in theory, not everything could be done by every key. Right, and that is just a traditional problem in PKI that I'm not trying to solve here. not widely available, but not hard to write either. I don't want to give you too many pointers, but I think I gave you a list of some keywords that you can look for. And all you really need to do, the easiest one, again, I'm not trying to make a statement on whether back orifice is a good thing or a bad thing, okay? So I'm not making that distinction here. But if you go under the assumption that people may not want back orifice installed, at least without their knowledge on their systems, then what you can do is you can actually go out to the net, you can take something like back orifice, you can take something like Joiner, and you can take another program like an executable greeting card that you might have access to from American Greetings or somebody else, and put them together. So what the person sees at the top side is the greeting card, and what happens underneath is you've bootstrapped back orifice onto the machine. And so you could do a scan of the machine before and say, hey, there's no back orifice, and then you do a scan of the machine afterwards and say, hey, there's back orifice. So you could do those types of exercises and bootstrap programs in, which would, I think, have probably a similar impact. Not to give you too many clues. Again, don't try this at home. Right. Well, I'll tell you a story that I ran into a while back. I had several people who were non-believers, and they said, well, we have a policy in our corporation, people don't open attachments. And I said, okay, that's novel, I don't believe you. And they said, no, we really have this policy, we terminate people who open attachments. I said, so fine, I'm going to write a little program that all it did was send back the name of the person who executed it back to a server. So it really did very little. It's kind of like Hello World on the network. and I gave it to them, and I said, you know what, send it out. See who opens it. Send it around your company. See who opens it. And they got a little nervous, and they said, no, we don't want to do that. And so I said, okay, you know what, they won't open it because they know it's from you. Maybe that's valid. You're doing a test. They know your name. Here's a little email spoofing program. Put somebody else's name. Put the chairman's name. Put, you know, the person's immediate supervisor's name. Tell them something interesting is inside this object and see if they open it. And sure enough, you know, when they finally got around to doing this, they realized that their policy of don't open things didn't necessarily hold. So it's tough to believe that people aren't going to execute these things. Other questions? You guys aren't going to ask me. This is a crack team of semantic folks up front came to heckle me, and they're not heckling. All right. Yeah. This was due to a number of circumstances. This was not in the book, but I would be happy to make this available, and I'll send it over to Jeff as well to get it posted on the site.
One more thing. Working with the products that you have out right now, I'm wondering if you have some benign viruses, like
You know, one of the things that happened when I got to this company, I don't want to do product pitches, that's not what we're here to do, but one of the things that actually was a novelty when I got to Symantec, I said, well, so do we actually create viruses? Do we actually, you know, look to generate new viruses so that we can anticipate what the next one was going to be? And the answer was, well, oh, no, we don't do that kind of stuff. We don't want to release virus code accidentally or otherwise, so we don't write our viruses. So the answer generally is no, we don't release virus code, benign or otherwise. Oh, this was for afterwards? Okay. Generally I would say the answer is no. However, we can guide you into perhaps finding those sources out on the net. We can talk one-on-one, but generally the policy at Symantec is we don't make viruses, we don't distribute viruses, our goal is to solve the virus problem. What's that? No, we actually don't. We actually don't. The virus researchers that we have are very closed about that. They're a very interesting group of people. They have their own little subculture, and they're very adamant about this idea of not being part of the community of those who propagate viruses. So there is a clear-cut distinction between virus writers and virus researchers. And I would say that we're in the virus research category. Listen, folks, I'm glad you came out here. And again, I apologize for the schedule shift. We went a little fast this morning, this afternoon. I'll be around through the weekend if anybody's sticking around, so feel free to talk to me one-on-one. I'm supposed to announce that Arthur Mooney? Art Money, Assistant Secretary of Defense, is here speaking in the technical room immediately following, I guess that's Coliseum 4, or, yeah, 4. I guess that's over there. So thanks again for coming by, and I'll be around.